You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, Alex.
Hey, Nick.
You know what I'm excited about?
I can guess, yeah.
What were you going to guess? Because
I can guess. Will I guess? No. You know?
Don't come at me with your fucking 8th grade English semantics, you son of a bitch. I'm saying I'm excited about part 2 of the Greed movie. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah, that wasn't what I was thinking.
What were you thinking?
You'll never know.
Well, guys, we're back.
We're back. We had a great conversation. First part of the conversation last week with Kelly. Talked about pretty much everything under the sun.
And now we're going to talk about even more. Honestly, like, again, if you're expecting us to get right into the movie, sorry. Like, that's not going to... Like, you have to listen in for that movie.
It doesn't happen. It takes a while for us to realize that we're not talking about the movie. But if you're here because you love Broadway, which a lot of you are,
yes.
If you're here because you love acting, which a lot of you are,
yes.
Then it doesn't really matter because you're getting gold here.
Yeah.
Get gold here.
Alex, do you think that people are here because they love you? Yikes. Cut it right there.
Little justice. Fuck yeah. It's interesting how many people, your show's been going on for longer than this, but the pandemic pushed people into doing things that they wouldn't necessarily have done before. Like, I started doing these IG Live interviews, and then from that, I'm now doing an interview show with Dominique Wilkins.
Is that the dominant ones?
Yeah, which is crazy. But what I loved about the IG Live thing, and I was pushed by someone who was saying, do it. And I was like, no, no one wants to hear what I have to say. And they're like, well, then no one will listen. Just do it. And it didn't exactly fill the creative void, but it approximated. It filled what approximated the creativity, that void, you know? And it felt like connection. And it's just like, this feels like connection. And this is I loved listening to a couple of the podcasts before, a week ago after you asked me to do it. And I love the one with your wife. That's hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
I love how much shit the Alex and she gave you.
That's
that made
we do.
Me laugh out loud. I do want to say one thing about Men in Tights.
Please.
Men in Tights is not a very funny movie.
Okay, Alex.
Now wait. I'll say this as an old person.
Oh, my God.
Who grew up on the early Mel Brooks.
Yes.
And I will say the funniest thing about that movie is Dom DeLuise as the Godfather and the characters around him. And the guy who's like, I will take these cotton balls. I put them in my hand. And DeLuise is like, okay, do what you ever do. You know, the funniest part of the entire movie.
Sir, I'm going to come back to you. And
fight me.
I'm going to fight you on this. And Alex, please jump in because I need your help. I also hate how Alex is like literally just sitting here and like.
I know. I want to ask you about, because Alex, you're a film editor. I want to ask about that too, because I find the editing process, I got to sit in on some editing sessions.
Yeah, right? No, we're good. I mean, this is what.
No, I want to add. I got to sit in on some editing sessions, and both the dumping initial thing is like the editor goes the first take, like what do I do with this, and then some of the later sessions where they're getting stuff back from network. And I know that's TV and it's probably different, but I'm really curious about that too. And since we're now doing a two parter, I feel like we can indulge ourselves.
We're gonna get into everybody. What's fun about being friends with Nick is like I would never be exposed to these conversations otherwise. I grew up liking theater a lot and not ever thinking I would do it. I never, you know, I think I wanted to be in movies when I was 6, because who didn't? But like, I never had aspirations to act. I did high school theater and all that. So I get a lot out of these conversations, even though I'm not in that world.
I love that.
But yeah, editing's fun.
Editing's fun.
You know, the itch it scratches for me is like it's a blend of creative and technical. Like I have kind of like a type A need to organize and like make systems more efficient, which like editing is great for, in terms of like how much footage do you shoot and how do you organize it's all file types and hard drives and all this stuff. And then you distill it and then you get into like the work of it, creating something, you know, human and finding a story. Like most of the stuff I do is documentary, which I found that I love over time, just because it gives me a chance to like, usually I'm doing the interviews that I'm editing, then editing. So like I'll sit down and I'll talk to somebody and I can like pick their brain and guide conversation and then go home and like actually craft it into something.
Yeah,
that's fascinating.
But that's really, if I might say, that's, you know, not to, don't sell yourself short, because that's what you, you know, you have written and directed two films. You also are working on a novel. Like, you've done, like, you are a storyteller, dude. And I think that's...
Yeah, it's this creative world, you know, like, maybe I haven't been lucky enough to be, you know, on a Hamilton tour.
Shut up.
Who has?
But, like, I think if you're this type of person, like, no matter at what level you're doing it or how often you get to do it for money, like, it's something you're always going to be doing, right? You're always going to be creative. And if some valve gets cut off that allows you to do it in one aspect, your nature is just going to move you into another lane, and you're going to do it another way. So, like,
absolutely.
And this podcast is just one more representation of that. Like, as soon as we got bored, the second we got bored, we're like, all right, let's make a podcast. Let's talk about movie. Like, just to keep our interest
and
up.
That was back in freaking college too. So look at that.
Yeah.
Look at us. I love now.
And that. Yeah. And that's an extension of the relationship you guys have had for years.
Right.
But I also love, I mean, I do love the fact that the further I got into TV, the more I realized that the Uber storyteller, and I don't mean the car share thing.
Nice. Nice.
The Uber storyteller of that medium and film is the editor.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, we get to do whatever we want on stage. For we get to jump off the cliff and free fall for 90 minutes to 2.5 hours, 3 hours or whatever. But you could take filmed content and turn it into something completely different than what it was, or you can hone it to make it better what it was supposed to be, or closer to what it was supposed to be initially. You tell the story more than any other element, any other part of that process, including the actors and the writers. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, film is such a collaborative process, right? Because the script is obviously a huge part of it. Like, you can't have something without a story, without the dialogue, without the action. Like, it's a lot of work goes into it. But once you hand it off, there are things about character, and I'm sure you know, like, playing a character over many seasons too, like, things evolve. Like, there's stuff you can't find on the page, right? And the final product is the script plus the performances plus the music plus the everything. But all that stuff doesn't come together the way it's presented without the editor, who's going to decide which takes to use, and the director has his insight, but, like, which takes to use, what the pacing is. And we did this in film school, I think, where you kind of look at slight changes in an edit and what it can do to the, like, completely change the tone of what you're watching, how long a beat is. And it becomes fascinating to watch just how much pacing matters, how much, you know, how long, when you're cutting, who you're cutting to, what you're cutting to. It really makes a big difference. And they say, you know, the best editor is one you don't notice, right?
Yes.
My favorite example of this is the simplest, and my favorite is when they take sitcoms, three camera sitcoms with laugh tracks, and you just take the laugh track out.
Yep.
And it turns into, especially like Big Bang Theory or Friends, like shows that the jokes are not funny at all. They're creepy. Like the humor is unsettling, but the laugh track makes you think that what they're doing is funny. And as soon as you take it out, you realize, oh my God, like, the combination of all these elements so informs what the audience is going to feel.
That's a great.
So you got to go to YouTube and just deep dive on sitcoms without laugh tracks. It's terrifying.
That's a great point. I did that with Friends a long time ago, and I need to do more of it.
Yeah.
I had something I was going to say.
Let it come back. Let it echo through you.
It was so. It's echoing through me, but it's not up to my brain and mouth yet.
Well, while you're thinking of it, I will say this. I will give you my 2 second pitch for Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Okay, back to this.
Which is this
nonsense?
Which is this? Dom DeLuise, obviously a legend, a comedy legend, and everything around him in that scene is hysterical. The Godfather satire is hysterical. I will also, however, point your attention to my former director, Mr. Roger Rees, as the Sheriff of Rottingham. Because it is truly, like, if you look at the people he's in the scenes with, all right, and I say this as somebody who, you know, working Peter and the Starcatcher, you know, my second big show, and this is, did either of you ever see Peter and the Starcatcher at all?
No. I saw it at Second Stages or whatever the place is. Yeah.
So Christian playing Blackstache. It's Alex. It's basically the prequel to Peter Pan, but it's like crazy, zany, insane comedy, but also just brilliant writing. Rick Ellis writing the script, being amazing. Roger Reese and Alex Timbers directing this thing. You're watching Christian Borle. You're watching Matt Saldivar comes after him. You're watching all these people, and you realize that Rick wrote that for Roger. That is absolutely a Roger because that's who he is. It is that just that understanding of not even being the star of the show, but what it takes to be a comedy genius and know how to give it to your partner, how to give those moments. And I think of the scenes like with him and Richard Lewis where he's like, I dared to catch a king's deer, like that whole sequence, which is insane. And his just navigation of that is on point. So I will say, okay. I don't know. The movie is, let me tell you, in terms of the Mel Brooks canon, but if I had to choose between that and High Anxiety, we're going High Anxiety every time.
Sure.
But that performance to me is, mwah. I love it. I love it. I love it.
I have to go back to it. And because I do love, me some Roger Reese.
Yes.
And I have, I know... So the thing about that movie and about later Mel Brooks for me yes. is that the pace seems to be off.
Agree, 100%.
And there's just something, and it's not slow or fast. It's not that because a lot of his early movies had weird long takes that were just hilarious. There was something in the air. There was something that there was an energy that just worked and was anarchic and just fucking funny and just shocked you and that was missing.
Yes.
But you're right. And I do say this to people all the time. It's like, all right, so in lesser holes, look for the things that actually rise from that. And I should check out Roger Reese as well.
Definitely check it. I just love him in that movie. And I feel like he was able to do some things that like, even with that structure, which was not the best Mel Brooks structure at all, he found ways of doing things and you know I really just love that. But this is again a perfect segue but you know we're talking about movies now, which is okay. Again, guys, this is the point of the pod. Like, I do want to make that clear.
An hour and 8 minutes later,
I know, but we're doing two now.
We're two.
We're really short of. We don't have enough material.
Yeah, right.
We got to keep talking.
We got to keep going on this. We got to keep going.
Wait. Okay, but wait. Like I know you want to segue.
No,
can I be
segue.
Can I be a dick and just ask?
Take it back.
Okay, so or not ask. I was so Alex Timbers.
Yes.
Alex and I did a reading together back when he was Alex Timbers, all small letters, before he was like all capital letters.
Yes.
And then, and I liked him, and we made each other laugh. And then he asked me to do something when he was directing a show for Director Fest.
Yes.
Written by Elizabeth Merriweather,
who
wrote New Girl.
Yep.
And it was, it was initially called The Night Michael Showalter Fingered Me.
I fucking love it. I'm already in.
And they were like, you can't call it that.
Yes, you can.
So it was called The Sketch Comedian.
Oh, God damn.
And it was so, but I play, so there was some sort of situation that happened that was described in this play. And I did a one act play with Alex Timbers.
Yes.
And it was really, really, really fucking fun.
Yes.
It was hard. But it was fun. And I loved him. And I always did. I know people say this, but I always had the sense you're great.
Yes.
You're great. You have so much patience as we try to figure out the tone. And he's a master of tone.
Yes, he is.
He was rigorous and detail oriented on a level that until we actually put it in front of the audience or until it actually started working, I was annoyed by. And I was like, oh, no, of course you have to be. Yes, this is great. I weirdly learned so much in that one little 2 week period we rehearsed this play from Alex. And I am thrilled. I would love to work with him again at some point, but I'm thrilled that he has created such an amazing career for himself. And I didn't know you were in Peter and the Starfish.
Oh, yeah. Peter. Well, and here's what's crazy about that. So I had auditioned for Peter way back it was one of those things where Alex really, he again, saving my butt. So I was, my Broadway debut was Motown. Motown the Musical, which is a fucking trash fire. And that's said with all love to everyone who was in it. And y'all know if you were in it that it was a trash fire. So I'm not saying anything new. But so we do that show. And then I go off to Old Globe and I do The Last Goodbye at the Old Globe. And The Last Goodbye was the text of Romeo and Juliet mashed up with Jeff Buckley music, and
sure.
And Alex was directing, and wow. Alex is such a, I think truly he is such a film nut, and I know that because he was making fun. I think not Solaris, but what, Alex, you'll know, what is the George Clooney movie? It's George Clooney, Sandra Bullock in space.
Gravity.
Gravity, yeah. Had just come out, and we were having huge debates about Gravity. Like, we were having massive debates about that movie. I'm not going to say who's on what side, but I love that movie too.
But you're not going to say who's.
I'm
on
not
going to
say
side.
Who's on what side, but yeah. I loved it. But the he has such a cinematic eye. In two senses. And number one, the tangible. It seems that he loves the tangible. He loves theater that really shows you. So like, he brought in a fight director from London. The violence in this show was spectacular, and I mean that in the most like homage way. Like, he knew how to direct that violence and how to light it and how to make it something. Like when Mercutio got, we were all fighting with like katanas and cleavers and crazy. Mercutio gets stabbed, the blood like spurts like yay high, like it's insane. Wow. But I say all that to also say that, to your point, Alex is, I think that just like a film director, delegation is his strength, and he knows that he has his vision, but if he puts the right people in the room and pushes them this way and pushes them that way, you're going to come up with something that is unlike anything you've ever seen. And that, I think, I saw him do it in The Last Goodbye. You see it in Starcatcher. You see it in Beetlejuice. You see it in Moulin Rouge. Just like somebody who has such grand vision that requires so many components of collaboration, and is able to bring them back into a funneled thing. So Alec, yeah, he, I love him, and he's just a good guy. Also, like he is really good guy. Now here's a question.
He's one of the kindest people I've worked with in the theater, and I hear from everyone I hear as his star has risen, he's maintained that. Oh, sorry, yeah. You had a question.
Well,
sorry.
Here's my question, and this is actually, we can keep this in the thing, I don't care, but I have been sitting, and I have to go to the bathroom really bad, and there are no lights on in my room right now because darkness has fallen, and I haven't had a chance to get up.
You want to pause for a second?
Can we take 2 minutes?
Yeah, I'll go pee too.
Yeah, Alex, keep recording, and we'll come back.
Yeah,
and
we'll keep it rolling. You guys do what you got to do.
All right, we'll be back. 2 minutes. Bye.
Am I back? Can you hear me?
Oh, we can hear you, buddy. You're
everybody
great.
Sounding good. You guys relieved and ready for round two?
My lights are on. You know,
like, I was thinking we probably should have just like ended the episode there.
No,
natural
keep it going.
Break point.
Uncut.
Dive back in.
We should just release like a fully director's cut version.
I mean, it'll probably just end up being that.
It'll probably be beautiful. Just like,
this is too much to edit. So, you know, all or nothing. I'll just leave it alone.
Just everybody, take it as it is, and that's what you get. Yeah, man.
I'm sorry, I talk too much.
No, you don't.
No, this is great.
No,
so I'm looking at. Go ahead, Alex. Sorry.
No. Well, I was going to say, because we're a film podcast, but we're on the Broadway Podcast Network. So like, anytime we get a really good theater conversation going, you know, it's going to be
scoring points
for our audience.
That's a good point. I mean, of course, now part of me is like, oh wow. Is people going to be like, Denzel Washington was a jerk to Kelly O'Connor?
No, they won't.
Because he wasn't. It was such a great lesson. Like I always talk about, and I think even then, that was a long time ago now, I always talked about people playing ball, you know, like literally that phrase. And I know I say it a lot, but it speaks to so much. It explains so much to me. Like, this wasn't working because they weren't playing ball. They were playing ball. That was great. And then you can obviously get into more details, but he was just asking me to play ball. And I was initially
nice
intimidated. And then I fortunately had a guy who decided to be a mentor and say, fucking play ball. It was great.
Yeah, it's like people have, at his level coming back to theater with the name that he has and yeah. all of that. Like he could have just walked in and not and just run through the motions and done it.
Totally.
So like it's nice to hear that in the work, in the craft, in the actually like getting down when he didn't have to, that he still cared that passionately to like engage everybody around him and expect the best. And like it's
yeah.
It's, yeah.
Yeah, he set the tone. I mean, it's funny. He wasn't like he protected himself too. He was he took his moments to be to get his rest, which is great. And some of the rest of us who didn't have as much weight as he did, might be, you know, in the green room being like, hey, whatever. But he was part of the ensemble and he led the ensemble, and it was an extraordinary experience.
Yeah,
and we also had Colm Feore.
Well, I was supposed to say, you literally had like the all-star, like him and William Sadler.
Bill Sadler.
Was your freaking
wizard. Jack Willis.
Oh my God.
We had some great, we had Tamara Tooney.
Oh my God. Yes, you did.
Jessica Hecht. Ugh. We had some amazing people and folks who have gone on to great things since then. John Douglas Thompson,
yep.
who was called by the New York Times one of the premier classical actors of the last 10 years. He did a series of Othellos.
Oh, no, I saw his Othello, and it was out of control.
Did you see it up at
the Berkshire
Shakespeare and Company, or went down in New York?
I saw it. I think it was. Well, no, because I saw it when it was out at... It was in the Berkshire. So where the hell was that?
Okay, that was up. I think you saw it at Shakespeare and Company.
Yeah, Shakespeare
then,
and Company.
Atlantic, yep. Massachusetts. Yeah.
Yep, that's right.
And that was and the weird the crazy thing was that got so much press, but no one got to see it. Very few people got to see it. And then he came back to he did another performance of it, a production of it here in New York, and I thought it was the same show that moved, but it wasn't. It was a different production.
Oh wow!
And he got just such, you couldn't get tickets. It was crazy.
Yeah.
He's a great guy. He's a fantastic actor. He's bigger than life. And the way he attacks Shakespeare is bigger than life. And so it was so perfect for Othello. And then he did the Hairy Ape, I think.
Yeah.
Wasn't that?
Yeah.
Like, and that was a show, like an impossible show to make work. Oh. Willem Dafoe had just done it. And apparently it was fine. I don't know. I didn't see it. So I'm making shit up now. But JDT, man.
No, he's. I mean, because he was in. I was so pissed because wasn't he just in? I might be mixed. No, he was in. Was he in Nathan Lane's Iceman or Denzel Washington's Iceman? Because he was in one of them.
That's a very good question. I'm
not remembering which one.
If only we had some sort of computer.
I know, some sort of thing, some sort of technology
that could look that up.
I'm looking.
I don't remember, but you're right. He was. He was one of the.
He was one of the.
The denizens of the bar.
It was Nathan Lane's. It was Nathan Lane's, and I wish I could have seen him do that. Because
did either of you see him do Satchmo?
No,
he played Louis Armstrong in a one man show about. It was extraordinarily good.
Of course, it was
extraordinary. Dude. The guy is. He came to acting late too. He was a salesman.
Are you serious?
And he came to acting late. I'm going to say this, and I'm just pulling a year out of my ass, but I like maybe at 30. And everybody should look it up because I could be completely wrong, but he came to acting late, and he just has an innate ability to connect with an audience and a character and to get into a majesty of a character and not shy away from the foibles and the negatives. It just, it's not the negatives. That's the thing. He doesn't look at them as negatives.
No. Yeah.
But, he is one of the extraordinary, I hate saying this about friends and I don't hate saying, that's not what I'm saying. It's awkward saying this about people you know and who are your friends, but he truly is one of the great theater actors of our time.
Yes, he is.
And there was a whole article actually about him. Somebody who did one of the Jason Bourne movies. It wasn't Greengrass. I don't think it was maybe the next guy. Maybe it was Greengrass. Who saw him on stage and was like, I'm casting you in this. And the whole article was about both. It was about a number of things. It was about his theater career in the Othello. It was about getting cast in the Bourne movies and it not working. Mm. And him talking about how I just couldn't get it. And the director talking about how that was an odd thing, that it didn't work. And about the Satchmo that was happening. I might be conflating things, but I think the article was about all of it. And I thought that was a really fascinating and to his credit, a wonderfully vulnerable thing to share with people, to be able to say, I couldn't figure that out. I know that I'm good in theater. I couldn't figure out a way to make it work on screen. He has subsequently made it work. I've seen him in stuff, and he, because there's nothing that JDT can't do. But I just thought it was an extraordinary piece that worked because he participated in it without ego, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's a sort of shocking thing to say about an actor, about any of us. But anyway.
That's the selfless actor. I think that's exactly. Yeah. And when somebody knows how to, the thing I remember about his performance, I describe it as playing positive action. It's, mm-hmm. I love the actors who play to win and who are coming in there knowing, it's not about the emotion, right? Everybody's like, oh my God, how do you cry on stage or how do you cry on set? It's not about that. It's, I'm going to fight for my character so hard that tears naturally coming. That's what I remember specifically about his Othello, was somebody who just had such a command of this character and knew how to almost confuse himself to a point where then these explosions are organic and they're coming because it's a man who doesn't know what to believe. And it's that much passion behind it. Truly. I love that.
A great way to look at it. I had not thought of it in those terms, but yeah, fascinating.
No, he's the man. He's the man. We could talk about this shit all day, and I will talk about it all day, and I'll text you after, and we'll do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, this is, I do want to, you've got to talk about some movie, like a movie.
Okay, wait, before we do that, I want to say one more thing. Alex, about editing. One of the things that I found so fascinating about editing, my long slow journey about towards learning more about other elements of this world than acting, there was a director who told me that, it was fun working on the show. All we did, the first pass we did at editing, was cut half the pause between every single line that you guys had. So literally, they went through their first pass was having the time between every line.
Jesus.
Isn't that fucking cool?
Yeah. I mean, it should. They know exactly the pen. That's what I'm talking about pace and tone.
That's right. Speaking to what you said.
Yeah. It just moves fast. And it I think people get this expectation too of acting. Like, you watch a good scene in film or TV, and you think you're watching the actors play it in real time, right? You think it's playing out exactly at that pace, at that tone. Especially early on, like the first time you're kind of on a set and watching this happen, you see how many times it happens and how many ways that it happens. And where you end up after the edit is not at all where you started. Like, I'm sure TV gets to a point where things roll along enough that, like, you're doing 2-3 takes and you're out and you know kind of the timbre of what it is. But I love that. And it makes me really appreciate movies. We were talking, last time, two shows ago, about, Ghost Story, the David Lowery movie, you know, the kind of film where there's the confidence to just set a camera down and let the actors do it in real time and trust that the audience is going to care. Cause like, usually it's so far in the opposite direction.
Yeah, that's interesting too. And I've, oh God, what's the name of the movie? And I can't even think of the actors' names to actually.
What's the plot?
It was about Abscam in the 70s, and it was not Bradley Whitford. It was the other Bradley Cooper was in it, and
not American Hustle.
American Hustle. Yes. Okay, so American Hustle to me is an example of that. Like, it just, and I think I am in the deep, deep minority because most people think that's brilliant. I was just like, what is happening? It's all so odd. It's all such a, everything feels forced to me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys have thoughts about that? Since we're talking about movies,
yeah.
This has nothing to do with the theme, but I mean, do you have any thoughts about that movie?
Theme?
I haven't seen it. I have thoughts about David O. Russell for sure.
You know,
I'm pretty sure it was David O. Russell, right?
Yeah, yes, it was.
I think so.
Yes, it was.
He's definitely one of those directors who needs to be the director. you watch some of his secret behind the scenes filmed rants, and it's pretty telling about how he runs a set and how he builds a movie. And I'm sure that extends to the editing booth. Cause like you get into the editing room and like the directors, if he's breathing over your shoulder, if he's, you know, tyrannical in what he's doing, then it can so easily go over the top, or decisions can get made that maybe aren't really the right decisions, right? You could think all the way from the very beginning, like, this scene should feel this way, like this dialogue should cut this fast. It works in your head, and then you get there and you see it. It's like, oh, that, no. And you have to have the bravery to change course after actually seeing what your product is going to be. And for some reason, I feel like David O. Russell is one of the guys who doesn't really know how to do that.
It did feel to me with American Hustle that we were talking, you know, it definitely had that disjointed element that you're talking about, and again, we can only speak to how we interact with this movie, right?
Exactly.
We're not saying that the movie's a bad movie. If you like the movie, good for you. But like, yeah, I definitely felt that, as opposed to, you know, I always think of like the yin to his yang for me is like a Paul Thomas Anderson, right? Because that's someone who can sit on these shots, who understand, like, yes, do his movies sometimes run a little long? Sure. But the whole point of it is that meditative, reflective quality, right? There Will Be Blood is about pulling you into kind of a meditative, not a meditative world, but surely an all-encompassing world. Same with Phantom Thread, same with even something like Inherent Vice is all about that. So his pacing is on point. Then compare that to a David O. Russell, who I am probably the only one who still loves I Heart Huckabees. I do love.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah, I love that. Right, and that works. But like, that is few, and I don't ever feel like the guiding hand. I don't know. It's not,
like a style over substance thing, right?
Yes,
like
that's exactly right.
If you're gonna commit to something stylized, then the audience is going to need to trust that there's something to get out of it, right? That there's a purpose to it, that there's a reason, that there's some kind of metaphor or subtext at play that has guided the director to make this decision, as opposed to just like, yeah, this is me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was something about American Hustle that felt insular. It felt like an inside joke.
Yes.
It felt like we all really like each other, and we all find ourselves deeply amusing.
Yes.
And I was not invited along for the ride.
Yep.
Exactly. And I hope he's not listening to this. If he's listening to this,
we love you.
What I mean is, we all think you're a genius.
Yes.
No, but he is.
He's very good at what he does.
He's so good. Just,
you know, who are we to be sitting here talking about
right? But that's what made this movie such an interesting case for me, because it was so in the critical circles in which it was accepted as really good. It was like, this is a fucking brilliant movie, and I just didn't understand that.
I get that. I get that.
Anyway, I don't know why I'm going there. Why did I go there? That's a really... Well, okay, so...
Maybe you went there because American Hustle is a movie that falls into our theme.
Hey.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Look at that. Segway.
Segway King.
Segway King, guys.
Ooh, we've never had to get Segway before.
But
usually it's a war of who can come up with the cleverest segue.
But we did it today. Today he did it, and that's magical, and we love that. But the theme for today is, in fact, the Greed movie. That's what we put out, and that's what we want to talk about today. And you know, we've all selected these films that to us remind us of the Greed movie. I'm pretty sure, Alex, that you are going to hate my choice.
I guarantee it.
I'm pretty sure you're not going to like it. But I think let's start as we always do. What defines the Greed movie? Obviously, this is a perfectly ambiguous setup so that we can all have a different POV on it. But what is a Greed movie to you, Alex? Let's start with you. What does that mean?
I thought about it for a while. And I think what it boils down to is greed. A greed movie is a character movie, first and foremost, right? It's about somebody. It's yes. about why somebody wants something. Because what is a story besides desire, right? It's somebody wants something and they try to get it. Somebody needs something, they try to get it. Greed is the excess of want and desire. It's desire overriding
yes.
reality. You know, it's some fixation becomes more important than doing good, being good, living right. And it doesn't necessarily need to be money, but most of it revolves around money, around power, around kind of the material world, because it's, you know, tale as old as time. Somebody, you know, getting corrupted by all of that vice.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's about fixation, I think.
I love that. Now, do we feel that within that Greed movie, like what is, we talk about, yes, that kind of excessive reaching for the stars. What then becomes, is this a person that we're supposed to be rooting for? Is my question.
I think the movies can really tend to, even if it's someone you're rooting for, the character is going to let you down somehow, right? Because there's that inevitable, they've gone too far. In order for them to learn their lesson, they have to take it too far. There's sort of that built-in story arc of somebody who is greedy or gets greedy. Whether the whole point is to hate them from the beginning and just watch what they're doing, or watch them fall into a hole and lead themselves down this path.
Yes.
I think there does have to be, the arc is kind of built in, I guess. I don't know. What do you think?
What do you think, Kelly?
I feel like anything I say is going to give away what I
goddamn
the movie that I chose, but it's what I love is the idea that the Greed movie, what I looked for in the Greed movie was something that was slightly off, that wasn't obvious.
Yes.
I don't think I actually found that, but I do think it's subverted slightly. Mm. So
mm-hmm. I love that. So there it is.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Well, I tried to find ways. Because my inclination when I'm picking a movie for this is always to try to find something that subverts a little bit, right? That like addresses the topic, but in a way you wouldn't expect. Sometimes I can find one. Sometimes I can't. I couldn't find one for this, but it seems like it should really exist. And I'm sure it does. Like, maybe I just needed to spend a longer time. Because like greed, I want to find like an emotional greed movie, right? I want to find somebody dealing with the consequences of like wanting too much out of a relationship or out of some emotional commitment. And I know it's out there.
There's something about Mary should have been our choice.
I agree on that one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Let's talk about that.
That would have been good.
I will say, guys, not to gild the lily here, but I think I might have found it.
I think I found
the subversive greed movie. I think I did. I really think I did. And you got, again, I'm positive that you guys are both going to be like, Nick, get the fuck out of here. That is not a movie about greed. However, I think it is. I think that if you really break it down for what it is, I think it is.
If you can pick Inglourious Basterds as a new job movie like you did last week, then can do whatever you want.
Inglourious Basterds is a new job movie. They are all on a new job. The job is Nazi hunters, okay? That's their job now. I'll kill you.
Taking the bar instead of the
side. I cannot wait to listen to that episode.
Oh my God, it's so ridiculous. All right, so I'm going to set this up for you guys. I'm going to set this up. And you guys, I mean, you're going to get it in 2 seconds.
Okay, wait, remind me of the rules.
So the only rule is we're going to give each other the first 2 to 5 minutes of this movie, like just describing it, right? We're describing it to each other. And as soon, if you know it, guess it. That's it. Like there's no prize. Like we don't give out prizes here. We don't have that kind of money. Do you know what I mean? But like when you know what the movie is, which both of you will know probably within 5 seconds of me talking about it. Just say it. Say what you think it is. That's the only rule, right? Alex, am I missing anything? Was I wrong?
No, that's pretty much it.
That's pretty much all we do here. So I'm going to say this.
Little justice is that.
Little justice. It's real simple format, but yields massive results. All right, let me see if I can describe this. So we open on, obviously some logos and such. But once we get past that, we're fading in on what looks like almost like a Grand Canyon-esque desert. And we see, we hear shouting. Somebody sounds like an adult trying to organize some kids, maybe some young men. And this, shot of kind of these Grand Canyon-esque rock formations pans down to, we see these kind of figures amongst the rocks. And, they're all dressed in variations of green and yellow. Once we get closer, we're going to see that these are Boy Scout uniforms. And there is a troop leader organizing these scouts, trying to keep them corralled. One young man, one Boy Scout.
Meatballs.
Shut your mouth. It is not Meatballs.
It's a solid guess.
It was so solid. It is so solid, but it's not Meatballs. I'll keep going. But you guys, again, once you get it, you're going to know it. One young man and his, I will say, his pleasantly plump friend are sneaking off. And, the pleasantly plump friend is like, hey, we got to be careful. And he's like, no. Like, you stick with him. If you stick with him, if you want, I'm going to go find some real cool stuff. They go into the caves by themselves. They're wandering these caves. Into the caves in these rock formations, and they hear digging. They hear digging. So they go and they're searching.
Oh, Indy.
Come on, baby. There we go. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, baby.
Boom, baby.
Late 14th century Ming Dynasty. Oh, it breaks the heart.
And the head. You hit me dead.
I'll never forgive myself.
Don't worry, I'm fine.
Thank God. It's fake. See, you can tell with the cross sections.
Now, here's what I'm saying. This is why I think it's the subversive choice, because obviously, Indy is not greed at all. Indy is all about it belongs in the museum. That is the line that is said over and over in this film. However, he is in a world that is about greed.
Yeah.
Right. That's literally the world that he's thrown himself into. And that's why, the best lines, the quest for the grail is about, it's about the divine within us, right? That's everything that he's interacting with is about this choice between self-gratification and the longer road, the penitent man must pass. All these things about humbling yourself before God and before the universe.
Who are you?
The last of three brothers. Who swore an oath to find the grail and to guard it.
It was 700 years ago.
A long time to wait. I was chosen because I was the bravest, the most worthy. The honor was mine until another came to challenge me to single combat. I pass it to you.
That is, I was just thinking, because I was like, okay, yeah, there's definitely movies about greed, especially, given Kelly, your presence on the show, I could easily go for something that is about, the financial market or something like that, which is still an amazing choice. But for me, I was like, okay, I think that this actually might be the way to go. I think it's just a great interaction with greed and coming out ungreedy, not greedy. Until we
get, and
go ahead.
And saving himself, actually.
Exactly.
The third one, saving himself, because this was the beginning of the third one, wasn't it?
The beginning of the third one. That's right.
Right. Yeah. Saving himself because he was not willing to reach for the greed, whereas the woman,
Elsa, yeah,
the Nazi sympathizer,
poor Elsa,
shockingly, was not willing to not reach for it.
And that's what I love is that just that dichotomy of people who, truly, like you know, there's people who purport themselves to be, and again, we're not trying to break down Indiana Jones as like the philosophical fable of our time. But what I am saying is that, you know, I think the beautiful thing with Elsa, with Donovan, these villainous characters, is that at first they present to be people who are in the search for the Grail as educators, as people who are interested in this archaeologically, you know, just as a piece of history to be protected and contained. And then you realize that those very people are the people who actually are in it for the greed and are in it for themselves and to build, you know, and Donovan doesn't even care about the implications that it's going to have for the Nazis. He's just like, pay me my money. Do you know what I mean? Like, he doesn't, you know, I mean, it really is this kind of crazy thing for him, this kind of, you know, war profiteer for him. So it's very, I just love that. I love that, like, to win the movie, Indy and Henry Jones and Salah and everybody had to make a choice against greed.
I mean, do you think that there's an element of the Indiana Jones character that is like, yes, he's, you know, Robin Hood in a way, where he's trying to protect these things and he's coming from an academic background. It seems noble sort of what he's doing, but he also lives a life of like, he brings it on himself, all the trouble that he gets into, right? Like, and he drags people into it with him. Like, he's addicted to adventure and he's addicted. Like, he, there is an element of greed in that he will never stop.
Yes.
Until he's, you know, reclaimed every treasure in the world. It's like, not even about the treasure. It's about himself, which is greed.
Well, also, there's an element of, like, what are the museums that you are putting these in?
Right.
We never ask.
What countries are these artifacts being put in? And they are probably British or American institutions. And that's not where they... This belongs in a museum. Well, does it belong in your museum?
Yep.
Right, yep. He's going to all these different countries and taking things and bringing them back to England. Well,
and that's, I think that's actually what's kind of, again, a subtle message in this movie, but that's kind of cool, is both him and his father, right? Both of these men who spend their lives trying to bring these things out, they, in the end, they walk away with nothing. They don't get the Grail. They don't get any proof that any of that ever happened, right? It's they ride off into the sunset because the whole thing was like, no, we actually have to let it go. We ourselves can't be colonizers. We can't keep coming in here and taking these things. We have to let it go. And that is,
I guess, is that the end of all three of them?
Yes. And yeah. And then we get to probably the biggest meditation on greed of all, which is the fourth one. Not for reason.
But wait, before you go there, that's really interesting, because you're right. I said that Indy made the choice to not do the same thing Elsa did.
Yes,
right.
But it wasn't a given.
No,
it was his father that was like, let it go.
Let it go.
He gets them to that point, and then he is refused by the circumstance or by someone else the ability to take this thing home.
Yeah,
and the outcome's always good. Like Temple of Doom, he frees slaves, basically, right? These children and families that have been enslaved, like, that's a great outcome, but he walks away with nothing, and you could tell he's kind of bummed about it.
always, you know, and that's, I think that is exactly on the money. It's just that, you know, this person who does have, like, it's not saying, if we're to extrapolate the moral of Indiana Jones, it's not saying that it's not, obsession is not a wonderful thing, but that you do have to come to a point where humanity and life and your father, do you know what I mean? Like, choosing those things, core values, over the intrinsically self-gratifying values.
Yeah.
I think
if they turned Indiana Jones into like a really good show, you could explore all that stuff. I could see it being like really diving into who that guy is, because it's pretty fascinating.
Oh, it's awesome.
Yeah.
It's awesome. I mean, and I will say, you know, I mean, he, you know, he laid the groundwork. Anytime you have a Tomb Raider movie of any kind, right? I'm not saying the Tomb Raider franchise. I'm saying, like, even The Mummy, right? You're borrowing from that idea, and I just love that. I love that is how they interact with it, and it's just a very cool way to give another layer to your character. You know, just like, yeah, he's actually he doesn't get what he goes after all the time, but he does greater good, and that's always
accidentally
awesome. So that's my greed movie, y'all, is Indiana Jones.
I like
the Last
it.
Crusade. Thank you.
I like it.
Thank
I like
you.
It.
See, I did it. I did it. Lovely. Alex, go.
All right, my turn. Yeah. So from the beginning of us doing this podcast this way, picking topics, I knew that one day we'd do a Greed movie, and I knew exactly what my choice would be. And I'm not going to go with it because we've talked about it before, and B,
I know exactly. Yeah.
Kel, you might have chosen it. So I'm not going to talk about it yet. I'll wait until we've gotten through them all. But it is to me the quintessential Greed movie, hands down. And I've always said that like it's been so instructional for me, just from like a storytelling standpoint in terms of using theme to drive character. But I chose something else. I looked for a while. I was trying to be subversive. Mine is not subversive at all. So I figured I'd stick in the realm. But it is a little bit that the characters in it are not, it's an interesting balance of Greed. So we'll see. So, funny you guys should bring up Mark Twain in this episode, actually, because the movie opens on a Mark Twain quote.
Oh, good for you. I know what it is.
It says, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so.
I just want to make sure Steve Carell.
Yeah.
And Ryan Gosling.
Ryan Gosling.
And,
what?
What's my boy's name from Succession? Everybody, Hamish Linklater. Everyone. We're talking. The movie, of course, is The Big Short.
The Big Short
is the film.
Great.
Institutions movies. Treat these CDOs like they're as solid as Treasury bonds, and they're going to zero.
No, it can't be right. There are $500 billion in housing bonds. So last year alone, the ratings agencies, the banks, the fucking government? You're saying they're all asleep at the wheel?
Yeah. My whole department's long on this stuff. They call me Chicken Little. They call me Bubble Boy. A's, zero. B's, zero. Double B's, zero. Triple B's, zero. And then that happens.
What is that?
That's America's housing market.
The Big Short. Yes. Great movie. I love
it. Should have won the Oscar that year.
Agree.
Absolutely. And he tried to do it again with what was the movie about Dick Cheney?
Oh, Vice.
Vice. In terms of tone, in terms of editing, I mean, we're talking about editing. This movie is maybe like the best edited movie of the last decade.
I agree.
In a lot of ways, in terms of how you take a story. I mean, this is just a story about the housing market crash and the elements that led into it. How you make it interesting, how you make it relatable, how you make it informational, like instructional, right? Because there's a lot of elements of the housing crash that people don't understand, and banking and how it all works. And I think the industry kind of it operates the way it does based on the fact that a lot of people just don't understand it. Yes. And it's intentionally vague. And so to have a movie be about that and be mile a minute, loving every second, like you're laughing your ass off, you're terrified because all this stuff happened and is real. It's breaking the fourth wall all over the place. From a construction standpoint, this thing is incredible.
A collateralized debt obligation. It's important to understand because it's what allowed a housing crisis to become a nationwide economic disaster. Here's world-famous chef Anthony Bourdain to explain.
Okay, I'm a chef on a Sunday afternoon setting the menu at a big restaurant. I ordered my fish on Friday, which is the mortgage bond that Michael Burry shorted. But some of the fresh fish doesn't sell. I don't know why. Maybe it just came out. Halibut has the intelligence of a dolphin. So what am I going to do? Throw all this unsold fish, which is the triple B level of the bond, in the garbage and take the loss? No way. Being the crafty and morally onerous chef that I am, whatever crappy levels of the bond I don't sell, I throw into a seafood stew. See, it's not old fish. It's a whole new thing. And the best part is they're eating three-day-old halibut. That is a CDO.
But so The Big Short, like I said, it is a movie about what the elements that led up to the 2008 housing market crash and the guys who identified that it was going to happen and worked to profit off of it. And you watch it's different teams of people, coming at it from different angles, all kind of seeing it in their own time and making different moves in regards to it. And some of them identifying and some of them not, sort of the deep moralistic problem of profiting off of impending doom. which I think is you know, it's a movie about the greed of everybody else, and then questioning how far do you need to go? Like, what is your responsibility when you understand that other people are being greedy in a way that's going to affect everybody else? And I don't know, you know, it doesn't ever really answer it. It kind of lets you make up your own mind.
No,
I think
it really, so Adam McKay, I think, is just the master right now of the essay film. And and the idea that you start with a thesis, right? I mean, truly, these movies are essays. They are both this right. and Vice are about topics, about, you know, Vice being about power, you know, this being about greed. And you give us characters, but the point of the movie is not the characters. The point of the movie is the topic, is the theme. And you are laying it out in a way where it will be instructional to us. We will learn something quite blatantly by watching. But you fill it with characters who we do end up liking. And you also, you know, I love the cut, the Anthony Bourdain cutaway, where he breaks down what That's goes amazing. Into, yeah, you know, the fish stew. Like that is such a great way to break down that concept. Like, oh my God. And now we understand why, like, and what I think is so fascinating about what I love about that movie in particular, is that the concepts themselves, these things that seem so crazy, actually are very simple concepts. Like, it's actually right. not hard to understand once you get through the jargon and the bullshit that they put in the way, to stop you from it. So I could go on for days about that movie. Good fucking choice.
Yeah.
Fucking choice.
Great choice. And yeah, it's one of those movies too that you can kind of watch it again and again and again. And like, you never really, like, maybe you understand the concepts a little better each time, but like, not really. Like, beginning to end, you just have fun on the ride. Like, it's so rare to find a movie that you just enjoy watching from beginning to end. You're going to laugh at the same jokes. You're going to be interested in the same things. You're going to feel the same stuff. I mean, I love it.
I remember one of the things that stuck with me. You know, they had that, like, the ticker at the end about where are these people now. Mm-hmm. I'm not remembering his name, but he was the crazy investor. He also played Batman. What's that actor's name?
Christian Bale.
Thank you. Christian Bale. Yeah. And they talked about how his money is in water.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's looking at water.
So and I remember first thinking, we're fucked. Nice. Because someone's gonna own the water. And then I was also like, I gotta call my broker. Oh fuck, I gotta get a broker.
Yep. That whole thing.
It's like something you all need. Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know if you guys pay attention to the news, but the stock market right now, there's a crazy thing going on that actually the guy that Christian Bale's character is based on is a real guy who predicted the housing crash. He had invested last year or 2 years ago. He bought a big chunk of GameStop that was like going out of business, and he invested huge into it for some reason. And it kicked off this chain of events that got to the internet. And in the last like week or two, as a joke, as a meme, there's like a subreddit of investors who are all about like YOLO, like, you know, ever since Robinhood, the trading app, added options like calls and puts and stuff. You could do big trade stuff on this little phone app. So this huge community decided they were going to ramp up. There's a lot of people betting that GameStop, which is like going out of business because nobody buys these things physically anymore. The stores are shutting down. There's so many people that are betting against it failing. This community decided to just rally together. And the price has gone from like $4 a share to like $350 a share in the matter of like 2 weeks.
Is that what this is? I keep seeing the headlines and I'm like, I have no
insane thing. And I found today when I Googled this guy, because I was watching the movie, he's the guy, he kind of kicked off the whole conversation, and now he's turned on it and said it's super dangerous and like, Jesus, it's gonna implode everything. But it's just this fascinating like cultural experiment where like people don't understand how the banking system works or investment works, how Wall Street does what they do, and they rely on people not knowing that. So to have a community now that can communicate and operate in a way that says like, well, we can really flip this over. And if Reddit can destroy Wall Street, then it kind of deserves to be destroyed. we'll see what happens. But it's so all these firms that are holding on to, you know, had all these things. If they sell now, they take a huge loss. So they're waiting. they keep paying into it, waiting for this stock to crash back so they can make their money. And it may never come. They may like lose everything.
Good Lord. That's yes.
It's anyway, so Reed. Fascinating because I know less about the financial industry than I'm guessing 85% of the people listening to this right now. Which is weird, given that I'm sure about finance.
Most people do not know. I mean, I only know the words. I don't even know what calls and puts are. I just know what the articles I'm reading.
I don't even know what that meant. You said calls and puts, and I was like, I should Google this. I don't even. That's like Dollar Bill would know. I don't know.
Dollar Bill would know.
Good Lord, but that's the other good thing about Big Short. I will say, is that just that promotion of financial literacy, because that I think is what we need. I mean, that's what we need, especially going forward. Is just knowing what it means to know what money is. Like, what is it? What is it? Yeah.
Our schools should be teaching us that basic financial literacy. They should be teaching us civics, so we all know how our government works. And there are vested interests that do not want either of those things.
Oh, absolutely.
Vested interests. Yeah. Vested and have been. That. And again, this is longer conversation that we will have.
Yep.
I think that's the other thing we need to be educated on, is that these systems were built exactly as they are. They are functioning exactly as they were meant to. And that's the point. That's what we need to change.
And the problem.
And the problem. You know, so yeah, man, 100%. So Big Short and Indiana Jones. And now, you know,
okay.
the final, the best for last.
Hey. Okay. So if I'm gathering the way I need to do this, I'm going to describe some of the first images. There is a gentleman looking into directly at me, at us, into the camera. And it's very dark. And he's saying, listen very carefully to what I say. And he describes a series of events. And his background is dark. It gets lighter as we go along. And we see that there are cinder blocks behind him.
Yes. Ooh, you're
and
good.
And then all of a sudden, we get to Coney Island.
Yes.
And we see a car driving.
Yes.
And all it's stopping periodically along the water in New York. We see the background. We see various bridges. I'm assuming that bridge is the... that looks like Brooklyn. Might be Manhattan Bridge.
Yep.
A van picking people up. And then, all of a sudden, we get to a series of shots in downtown Manhattan, in the Wall Street area. And we get to
a bank
building.
Is it a bank?
Yeah, it is. And there's a giant American flag.
Yes, it is. Is there? Can I?
And then
ask you a question? Is there a man inside of this building who might stay there, an inside man, as it were?
There might be. Yes.
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 Yes. Yes.
As it were,
the inside. Yes.
You guys, cops.
Oh shit! Made us. Christmas came early for you this year. Bank robbery, hostage situation, 20 Exchange Place.
What?
Grossman's on vacation. You're up.
What about the Madrugada thing, the check cashing thing? I thought I was in the doghouse.
I just threw you a bone. As far as I'm concerned, you still work here. But if you don't think you're ready...
No, he's ready.
Oh, good. Good. I'm giving you a break here. Don't make me look like a fool.
I am so happy. Because, number one, I think that this movie's come up in another... Was it...
we do, I think, with Pete Chapman?
With Pete Chapman.
Heist film. I think.
But what was the theme?
Heist film.
Heist film.
Oh, God damn it.
No, but dude, that's we. No, I swear to God, because I love it, because it just shows how multifaceted these movies are. Inside Man. So talk to us about this choice. Talk to us about what.
Okay, first of all, I thought the fact that it's a Denzel Washington movie would be kind of fun because of our connection. When I first saw it, I was like, I'm not sure what I think of that movie. But I watched it the next day. And I decided it was one of the best heist movies I've ever seen.
Yes.
And it fucks with your loyalties. It's not overly cool. It's not overly anything. And Juwafor, I've only seen in one other movie. It was I can't remember, but it was about the hospitals it was fantastic. And I was just like, oh, it's that guy again. He's amazing. The connection between him and Denzel
yep.
was so true, and the way they dealt with the suspects, who were probably also most of them were innocent victims, was so not precious, and was like nobody was overly great.
Until he secures his position and gets the physical layout, he'll only dump on us. Show starts, he'll call us. Trust me, I've seen him work.
We'll call Keith.
You get that for me? I guess it is, isn't it? So one thing I learned from Grossman is these guys don't have much respect for what we do.
How do you mean?
Well, for them, it's a tactical situation. Us being here means there's a mental side to it that they don't get.
Told you you could handle this shit.
Keep waiting for someone higher up on the food chain to show up and say, here's what we do.
What happened at the hospital?
Guy shot himself, Johnny's girlfriend. Thank you.
And nobody was completely terrible except for the bank, the Nazi sympathizer bank guy. The person, Clive Owen, who was the bank robber and was ruthless, who you were set up to think was the villain, actually was trying to fuck with the guy who was the Nazi sympathizer.
Yes.
You know, who was the greedy one? They all were. Denzel, even at a certain point, his character.
Oh, yeah.
Is like, all right, I'm going to stop looking at this because I got detective first grade. Jodie Foster is like, yeah, I know. I'm working with a guy who was a Nazi sympathizer, but he pays well. You know, like it just fucks with all. I love a heist movie. I love a classic heist movie, but I love a movie that then sort of fucks with it. Like, what? Mm-hmm. Who are the people we're actually rooting for? Yes. And it challenged me, and I loved it, and I love the actors, and I love the connection between them. There were a couple of, when we were doing Caesar, we all knew he was doing that next. Spike Lee came to opening night, and I remember talking to him afterwards, and he mispronounced my name, and I had just auditioned for him. And so I even said something like, no, it's O'Coin. And he was like, oh, sorry, I got it. I was like, yeah, well, you know, make sure when you look at the tape, I said something stupid, but he laughed. It was, I don't know. The movie holds a soft spot in my heart because of that. But I also do think it was a really surprising take on a genre film. And, you know, I love Spike. I think he always has something interesting to say, even if it's like a failed take. It's much more interesting than a lot of people's safe successes. Does that make sense?
100%.
Totally.
And that's actually one of the things that I think we were saying last time that I love about Spike. In his work, is just I think actually what he does, with the exception of Malcolm X, which is possibly outside of Citizen Kane, one of the greatest American films ever made. It truly is that rags to riches in a very different way, but just that ascent story that we all need to see, but also in the context of the civil rights movement, all that stuff. But one of the things I think outside of that, I love Spike when he is playing with genre. Because all of a sudden, all the things that he wants to say sociopolitically get contained in a formulaic structure. So rather than it being everywhere, it's these little moments that just hit you that much sharper. And I felt it with Inside Man. I certainly felt it with The Five Bloods, which is another heist movie. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it just ekes out instead of smacks you with the baseball bat, which is great sometimes. Yeah. But like, I love that. I love that. I think it's marvelous what he does.
I mean, in terms of a Greed movie too, I think what I love to see, because Greed is really about intention, right? It's about people setting their sights on something and wanting it more than anything. And what do they want? And why do they want it? And what I love about this movie is, like, good guy or bad, however you're set up as a good guy or bad guy, because like you were saying, Clive Owen is supposed to be the bad guy. He's robbing a bank. He's really kind of serious and scary and all that. To get to the end and have everybody be right.
Yeah.
Just feels good. Right.
Except Christopher Plummer. Yes. Yeah.
Well, except the not right to have everybody except, like, you know, the banker owner who didn't have anything in play anyway, right? He wasn't trying. Yeah. He just assumed the world was going to bow to him and that everything was okay. Like he never put himself forward in any way. He never tried, worked against anything.
That's a good point.
Got exposed. It's nice to see that nobody is really, nobody's punished. Everybody gets what they came for, and you can still forget about it.
And the interesting thing, just at the moment when late in the movie, I was like, wow, Clive Owen and his team, they didn't do this for profit at all. It was just about exposing this guy. And then you're like, oh, they have the diamonds.
Yeah, no, they still, it's just like a normal successful heist. It's just they didn't steal what you thought they were stealing.
Yeah, they didn't steal anybody else's shit. The government doesn't even have to, there's no insurance that has to be paid to anybody. The right. Nazi got robbed, but they got rich.
Yep, dude. Everybody wins.
Yeah.
Fucking that is the definition of everybody wins. When the when the Nazi gets robbed, but everybody else wins. I call that a draw.
Mr. Frazier, I have spent my whole life serving humanity. You can ask anyone who knows me. They'll vouch for me. And for the things that I've done.
You think they'll vouch for you after I find out the truth about this ring? I don't think so. Oh, by the way, that thing you said about us being New York's finest, I want you to know we really appreciate that.
How gracious.
Let's go. We're going to follow that ring.
That's a good draw.
Yeah, man. Well, no, Kelly, you as we said when we started this, you were just such a fucking gem. And, you know, this two-part, possibly even three-part, I don't know, but it's going to be...
I don't know where I'm going to cut it in the middle. Like,
we're going to figure it out. We're going to put in so many little bits and bobs. It's gonna be great, but it's just been such a pleasure hanging with you, man, and we can't wait till you're back on set. We can't wait till you're back doing what you do, and please, I mean, what do you want to plug? I mean, obviously, you know, your amazing Dominant One podcast, but is anything else you want to throw out there?
I mean, that's gonna be fun. I think we're gonna drop hopefully in February. The fact that I'm doing a talk show co-hosting with Dominique Wilkins, who was one of my heroes when I was growing up, is amazing. We have a good time. It's just great. It's great to talk to you. It's great to chat with you guys. I'm going to give you verbal confirmation that you can cut anything that I've said. You can put this on the air. But this is great. And thank you for indulging me. I realize I talk a lot. So thank you for... whatever, this is great. This is just fun conversation.
Yeah, man.
Do you have any idea, getting down to business, when Billions might be back on the air?
No, I don't exactly, but I know that we are definitely trending towards getting back to shoot in March. I mean, not March, in spring.
Lovely.
Hopefully March. March would be great, but in spring.
Lovely.
Cool.
And then we're going to finish season 5 and immediately go into shooting season 6.
Season 6.
So... Awesome. I will say that there's a good chance that we will at least catch up a little bit on the back end.
That's great.
I'm excited to see it. It's going to be hard to top attempted chicken genocide, I think. I'm excited to see where it goes.
We will be found.
Yeah, me too.
And I will close out by saying I actually, during recording this, I received an email from Asia just randomly.
Oh wow, are you guys buddies?
Dude, did I not tell you about, so we did our first professional job together.
That's so cool.
The Hangar Theater in Ithaca. Yeah, yeah.
Rent.
In fact, I'm pretty sure I punched her in the face on accident during La Vie Boheme. It's a whole thing, or them in the face. I'm so sorry, them in the face. And I
had
to, because what I love about Asia and what they've been able to do is really bring a spotlight to their community and do it in a way that is having such great impact. It's just been a privilege to kind of watch them like rise and do their thing.
Agreed.
You know what I mean?
Agreed.
Like,
Asia's a wonderful actor, and their activism is inspiring, and their patience is like Job.
Yes.
And I love working with them and right back. I don't know, right back that Kelly says hi.
I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that. But Kelly, you're the best. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, so you guys much. Too.
Yeah, man.
This is such a blast. You guys are awesome. I love your podcast. It's really fun.
No, you,
thank you.
Thank you. Boom. Look at that. Look at that ending. And here we are recording another ending in the future. another ending for our wonderful talk with the wonderful Kelly. That was an amazing conversation, you know. And guys, we just want to remind you that this is, again, as we said in part one of this Greed movie episodes, this is the end. But it's not the end. It's just a rebrand.
This is the end.
So what happens,
this
Alex?
This is the beginning.
What happens from here? What happens from here?
So we have to take a couple weeks because you're so bad with technology. You're so inept. That in order for us to move, in order for us to transition into a reality where we have video, in addition to this audio, it's literally going to take us a month just to teach you how to use a camera.
It took them a month to teach me how to type. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was embarrassing enough. So now we got to put a camera in there, and I'm not sure.
We're going away. We're going to launch a website. We're gonna set up camera stuff and edit. We'll have a YouTube channel. We'll have all the things that you know and love. Will be back better than ever.
Back
better. Have to make sure that you don't fuck it up.
Maybe will we even have a new name, Alex? Do you think we're gonna have a new name?
It's very possible.
Oh shit! Like not something totally different from Little Justice, but like maybe like a little like it'll be almost like, you know how in the sequels they do like. Like the first movie is called The Croods and the second movie is called The Croods, The Journey Home or some bullshit. That's what this is going to be. It's going to be like
Or we could go Jurassic Park style. Like instead of Little Justice and a new name after it, it could be a new name, Little Justice, you know?
Can I ask you
Big
this?
Justice, Little Justice. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. If this is Lost World Jurassic Park, which one of us is Ian Malcolm and which one of us is Sarah Harding?
You could, I know, because you want to be Ian Malcolm. You can be Ian Malcolm. I'm the little girl in the very beginning who runs off the beach and gets eaten by the little scampies, whatever they're called.
I was actually going to give you Vince Vaughn, but you can be the little girl. Either way, you're good.
I want Vince Vaughn. I want Vince Vaughn.
Everyone wants Vince Vaughn. All right, guys. Well, look, here's the deal. Go listen. You have 30 some odd episodes to listen to while we do a little house cleaning, and we'll be back in a month with the new Little Justice. Bye.
Little Justice. Little Justice. Little Justice. Fuck yeah.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now. And get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.